The air was filled with cigar smoke and a smell of champagne and sweat-soaked hockey gear. On the wall was a hand-painted banner, "Embrace the Struggle." In the center of the room, the Giants coach, Don Hay, stood misty-eyed. "I'm just so proud of these guys," he said. "Just look around the locker room. There isn't one guy who didn't buy in wholeheartedly." Canadian hockey is a meritocracy. Thousands of Canadian boys begin to play the sport at the novice level before they are even in kindergarten. From that point on, there are leagues for every age class, and at each of those levels, the players are sifted and sorted and evaluated, with the most talented separated out and groomed for the next level. By the time players reach their mid-teens, the very best of the best have been channeled into an elite league known as Major Junior A, which is the top of the pyramid. And if your Major Junior A team plays for the Memorial Cup, that means you're at the very top of the pyramid. This is the way most sports pick their future stars. It's the way soccer is organized in Europe and South America, and the way Olympic athletes are chosen. For that matter, it's not all that different from the way the world of classical music picks its future virtuosos, and the way the world of ballet picks its future ballerinas, and the way that our elite educational system picks its future scientists and intellectuals. You can't buy your way into Major Junior A hockey. It doesn't matter who your father or mother is, or who your grandfather was, or what business your family is in. Nor does it matter if you live in the most remote corner of the most northerly province in Canada. If you have ability, the vast network of hockey scouts and talent spotters will find you. And if you are willing to work to develop that ability, the system will reward you. Success in hockey is based on individual merit, and both of those words are important. Players are judged on their own performance, not anyone else's, and on the basis of ability, not some other arbitrary fact. Or are they? This is a book about outliers, about men and women who do things that are out of the ordinary. Over the course of the chapters ahead, I'm going to introduce you to one kind of outlier after another, to geniuses, business tycoons, rock stars, and software programmers. We're going to uncover the secrets of a remarkable lawyer. Look at what separates the very best pilots from pilots who have crashed planes. And try to figure out why Asians are so good at math. And in examining the lives of the remarkable among us, the skilled, the talented, and the driven, I will argue that there is something profoundly wrong with the way we make sense of success. What is the question we always ask about the successful? We want to know what they're like, what kind of personalities they have, or how intelligent they are, or what kind of lifestyles they have, or what special talents they might have been born with. And we assume that it is those personal qualities that explain how an individual reaches the top. In the autobiographies published every year by the billionaire, entrepreneur, rock star, celebrity, the storyline is always the same. Our hero is born in modest circumstances and by virtue of his own grit and talent fights his way to greatness. In the Bible, Joseph is cast out by his brothers and sold into slavery and then rises to become the Pharaoh's right-hand man on the strength of his own brilliance and insight. In the famous 19th century novels of Horatio Alger, young boys born into poverty rise to riches through a combination of pluck and initiative. I think overall, it's a disadvantage, Jeb Bush once said, of what it meant for his business career that he was the son of an American president and the brother of an American president and the grandson of a wealthy Wall Street banker and a U.S. senator.